This is an ABC podcast.
G'day and welcome to Country Breakfast. My name's Clint Jasper. For years now, the granting of gas exploration licences on farming land has ignited tensions between resources companies, farmers and First Nations groups. And this week, we're looking at a new front in the debate on Queensland's Channel Country.
Our land is our mother. That is part of us and who we are. It's embedded in us, our country. That's our life. So if we look after our land will look after us. And it's not okay on any form or way to mistreat our land and treat it like it's going to be there forever.
Before we get to that story, though, Serena Locke is here to run through this week's rural news. Good morning, Serena.
Hi there, Clint.
The lingering shortage of protein in China from the disease African swine fever, which wiped out a third of its pig herd, means Chinese consumers are demanding more lamb.
Yes, that's right. And it's surprising because while China has steep tariffs on many Aussie foods, seafood, wine and barley, the country is still hungry for Australian red meat like lamb and sheep and also beef. Now, the Chinese government's lockdowns to control COVID are pushing the Chinese consumers away from the restaurants, but they are buying the sheep meat to cook at home and they're not going out. Now, Rabobank's animal protein analyst, Angus Gidleybaird, says banquets and business dinners have been killed by the pandemic. And Gidleybaird says the Chinese consumers are continuing to consume these animal proteins and the price is going up.
Beef and sheep meat retail prices in China are very similar to where they were last year and where they shot to after the African swine fever situation, whereas we saw pork prices drop quite dramatically last year. So they've continued to remain strong. That's also reflected in our export values. In fact, our lamb per unit export values are actually higher than where they were last year, even though our volumes are down.
Well, staying with China, the Chinese ambassador to Australia said his country was ready to resume normal trade, but there's a catch.
Yes, there is a catch. This week, the ambassador Zhao Chen addressed the National Press Club on the subject of our relationship that has been battered by the series of disputes over the last 2 years. And he says, although Australia's new government has begun to repair the bilateral relationship, China has not yet come to the stage to discuss how to solve specific trade and political issues. He says Chinese consumers have been sort of boycotting Aussie goods because of this high-level stoush and Australia's blocking of projects by businesses like ZTE and Huawei. So if Australia stopped picking fights, he says the Chinese people would forgive.
My expectation is that once we have a more positive messages, more positive actions, more positive policies to be taken by the new government, it's going to improve the atmosphere. And the people in China will be happy to come back to the market, to come back to Australia, to buy the best quality Australian products, which are very popular in China.
We will be talking water markets a little later in the show, but this week as well, the latest report card from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority shows that there's still plenty of work to be done to meet the water-saving targets of Australia's largest water reform project.
Yes, and the new chief executive of the MDBA, Murray-Darling Basin Authority, Andrew McConville, has only been in the job for 5 weeks, and he says New South Wales is behind the other Murray-Darling Basin states, such as Queensland, Victoria and South Australia. New South Wales hasn't completed its water resource plans, which set out how the water can be used in each catchment. They've only submitted only 3 to 4 plans of a possible 20. He says while the states still have to find the remaining 450 gigalitres for the environment, the water that has been recovered for the environment has been vital.
Where we sit, there are great benefits that can be achieved by returning water to the environment. And we should also remember that 2,100 gigalitres of water has been secured since the start of the basin plan. And, you know, that's been really important, particularly as we work through the last drought, because it was that water for the environment was really the only water connecting the Murray to the sea. So it is important. Ultimately, how that's recovered is a question for government. But, you know, we certainly see that it is going to be challenging.
New South Wales dragging the chain.
Yes, and they've only got a couple years left, and that's a worry about how they'll actually achieve the remaining water to be brought back for the environment.
Definitely. Moving on, farmers have had a win in the High Court this week against animal activists.
Yes, the High Court has rejected a challenge to the New South Wales government's so-called ag gag laws, which prohibit trespassing on land and secretly filming farming and other animal welfare issues. Now, the High Court said the New South Wales laws were reasonable and necessary to protect farmers' privacy and safety. The animal rights group Farm Transparency Project is understandably disappointed. Chris Delfour says the laws interfere with consumers' ability to make informed decisions.
They've chosen to restrict their decision to individuals, so it hasn't answered the question of whether media has that right and the broader question of whether consumers have the right to know what they're paying for when they're purchasing meat, dairy and eggs or they're attending a horse or a greyhound race.
I remember a few years ago, before the pandemic, we saw that series of stunts by animal activists who broke onto farms, took calves and goats, filmed in piggeries and chained themselves to abattoir equipment. There was a film and a map they published of many farms. So what's been the reaction of the farming industry to this legal ruling?
Yeah, well, understandably, they've welcomed it, the meat industry in particular. And now it was a majority decision by the High Court. The Australian Meat Industry Council's Patrick Hutchinson says secretly obtained footage can be easily misinterpreted.
We are more than happy to root out, find out and get rid of anyone in our industry that's not undertaking the most effective animal welfare outcomes. But I think more importantly, what this also shows us is that in a lot of circumstances, there is misinterpretation of the practices that people are looking at.
The law has previously prosecuted farmers for breaking it. So what's so different about this piece of legislation?
Yeah, well, I remember 5 years ago, egg farmers were secretly filmed, showing the hens were not let out of their barns for several days in a row. And the ACCC won those cases against several farms in New South Wales, in WA and in Queensland. Now, the egg cartons had stated the eggs were perfect free range, there were pictures of hens in pasture, and the wording was very specific about the eggs being free range. And those farms were heavily fined because really that breached the trade practices. They were not, as they said on the label. So this is different. This is a case about upholding a farmer's privacy, I suppose. So a professor who led an Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry into privacy says she agrees with the High Court's decision to uphold the laws that restrict the filming and broadcasting of allegedly cruel treatment of animals. Law professor at the University of Sydney, Barbara McDonald, says privacy laws need to be upheld.
I don't support the idea of somebody being able to breach the Surveillance Devices Act in New South Wales to trespass onto land and to record activities which are lawful. I understand the motives of the party in this case, but they really want to have the right to do things which even the police can't do.
Serena, there's a lot of focus at the moment on greenhouse gas emissions. Last week on the show, we were talking about soil carbon sequestration, but a majority of agricultural emissions come from fertiliser. So what can farmers do to lower that?
In broadacre cropping, fertiliser production and use accounts for about 58%, more than half, of the Australian wheat crop's greenhouse gas footprint over the past 5 years. Now, that's according to the Department of Agriculture. Now, much of that relates to nitrogen fertiliser. James Murray is Senior Research Manager at the Birchip Cropping Group, and he says there are several options farmers can use. There's a thing that you coat a fertiliser, which reduces the release of that laughing gas, nitrous oxide. But there's also a bit to gain from rotating wheat crops with more legumes.
When we're growing legumes, we don't need to actually apply N to meat production. So that's the obvious go-to option, is to grow more legumes so we're not applying as much nitrogen. In a synthetic capacity, it's not as simple as just grow more legumes and you're reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because there is greenhouse gases as nitrous oxide associated with the breakdown of legume stubble. So they certainly add to it as well. But yeah, they go a long way to starting to reduce that footprint.
I think farmers would like it if the urea didn't break down as quickly as well.
Yeah, so that coating on the fertiliser might be one of the really good solutions.
Serena, we hear Indonesians, with a bit of Australian help, are working very hard to bring the foot and mouth disease outbreak under control, but it must be some pretty tough time for farmers over there.
Yes, and the wet markets of Indonesia are quickly filling up with lots of cheap meat as smaller landholders rush to sell their stock before they potentially succumb to foot and mouth disease. And that means consumers can get cheap meat. Of course, that means also that the market is cheaper than Australian imported cattle. So it's bad news for Australian exporters. But there's also a looming shortage of fresh milk. Indonesian dairies are also joining the lineup of producers looking to sell their stock. Now, it's costing the Indonesian government billions of dollars, I suppose, in compensation farmers are getting, and also the vaccination rollout. Now, Robbie Agustia is the Director General of the Indonesian Cattle and Buffalo Farmers Association. He says it's a tough time for farmers.
When the local farmer get the FMD, they will be really panic and they sell to the abattoir and then or we call the potong paksa or slaughtering in their home. And then it's really cheap, the meat. Yeah, you know, already seen the, all the footage from the Indonesian farmer. They have the long queue, cattle waiting for the slaughtering.
Almost breakfast, pre-breakfast for many, so a bit early in the day to pop the cork off a wine bottle, but let's make this exception. Cork could be making a comeback.
Yeah, well, there used to be a fungal problem with cork taint, but research is solving some of those issues, and now some might winemakers want to use it again. Noah Ward from the South Australian winery Unico Zello says the return to cork is about sustainability.
The reason we use cork as a closure in general is that you can't grow a screw cap. It's a finite resource that you have to mine. And there's also that little plastic polymer that's, you know, not necessarily great for the planet, that won't biodegrade very well. But you can grow cork trees till the cows come home. So we do have a regenerative resource for this particular closure. But aluminium for cork, there is only a certain amount and it will take millions of years to reproduce it.
I just think that there's probably a whole generation of people who won't know how to open a bottle of wine with a cork corkscrew.
Well, you need the accessories.
Yeah, you do. You need that little knife, the little flick of the wrist.
You get caught little, short, you know, if you don't have a waiter's friend and someone brings around a bottle with a cork in it.
Yeah. Could be good, though.
Hey, Serena, thank you so much for that wrap of Rural News this week.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Clint.
Okay, buzzer's ready. Which favourite music quiz is back on the ABC?
Papa's got a brand new bag of spicks and specks.
Join Adam Hills, Nick Warhurst and Alan Bro with new celebrity guests.
I'm not here to make friends.
For great music and some fun and games.
These are Willie Nelson's actual braids.
That's genuinely distressing.
All new Spicks and Specks.
Thanks for watching.
Sunday nights on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
This week, we're tracking down heritage trees with a fig lover who's on a mission to find and document Australia's oldest fig plantings, grown from cuttings brought here by migrants starting their new life down under. We'll join a fire crew carrying out an aerial burn in Savannah Country on the Gulf of Carpentaria, and we'll meet the farmers getting their hands dirty in the name of science.
You need a shovel and a bucket and manure. So you take your shovel and you find a cow pat that's at least 24 hours old, put it in your bucket with some soil and then empty some water into it, and they will float to the top in a graceful style, and you can collect them and see what you've got. We now know we have 9 separate species of introduced dung beetles and 4 predatory species.
Investigating the fascinating world of dung beetles and digging into their power to improve soil. That is coming up. First today, how a chance sighting in a dense forest has reunited a rural fire brigade with a piece of vintage equipment, with a link to Australia's first all-Indigenous firefighting crew.
Captain of Newey Creek Brigade in Nambuckashire was driving through the Tambang State Forest on his day job, and through some trees he noticed a little flash of red and saw an old fire truck, and as us firefighters tend to do, we got a bit excited and he went and had a look.
That little flash of red turned out to be an important piece of firefighting history.
As he got closer, he saw that Bellbrook was emblazoned across the side, and he's also a member of RAFT, which is the remote area fire teams that our Deputy Captain Chunk Wade is a member of. So he was straight on to Chunk saying, we found your old truck, would you like to come and have a look? Chunk got hold of me very excitedly and said, can we go and have a look, Captain? I said, yeah, of course we can.
Adam Hall is the current captain of the Bellbrook Rural Fire Brigade on the New South Wales mid-north coast. He explains that when he and his deputy captain went to check out the old truck, he was quickly persuaded to raise funds to purchase it from the collector who owned it and to take on a restoration project.
I think about 2 seconds into seeing the truck, can we buy it, can we buy it, please? So after some discussions and photos out on Facebook and a GoFundMe page campaign, we were able to get the funds to buy the truck, and we have it here at Bellbrook Shed now, and we're going down the track of trying to restore it.
The truck was supplied to Bellbrook in the 1970s and became the primary truck used by an all-Indigenous branch based at the local Thungari Aboriginal community in the early 1990s.
We've got a really rich Indigenous history here at Bellbrook and very rich history of Indigenous participation in the brigade. And the truck in particular actually ended up as the truck that was the first all-Indigenous fire crew, and I believe the first all-Indigenous fire crew in the country. So rebuilding it is very important for the community, for our Thungari people here as well, and helping to bring some pride into our little village.
Hello, I'm Emma Siossian. I'm here at the Bellbrook Rural Fire Brigade shed, meeting some of the brigade members who are helping to restore this vintage 1960s Bedford fire truck. This truck holds special memories for Ray Quinlan. His late father, Eric, was part of the original Indigenous crew, inspiring Ray to also join the brigade.
Yeah, 3 points of contact, Ray.
It means a lot, like really much. I just want to keep following his footsteps and looking at all the old photos of him, you know, in the back in the days in his fire brigade suit. It just makes me real proud of him, and just want to make him proud of me. And I know he'd be looking down at me with it being that proud.
The Bellbrook Brigade Deputy Captain, Gerard Chunk Wade, recalls serving on the truck in the 1980s. He says it was a different era of firefighting.
Oh, I was amazed just to see it come back to Bellbrook and start coming back as the old unit that is just a piece of history, because I like that, you know, it's sort of, I think that's just gold, especially as an old petrol truck, petrol being the elusive word here, that you go into a fire with a big old petrol truck with big old petrol tanks down the side. Yeah. Remember standing in the back here where it was, there's not a lot of creature comforts or safety, and you had a bar to hang on to, and away you went, off to the fire.
Yeah. Things have changed a lot since then.
Yes, we're a proper fire service now, so. And and just little things, just the way the truck operates, and amazing that we could get it back. And hopefully we're going to return it to service just for training and historic service, just so people can see it. My biggest goal would be to be able to take it to Kempsey Show and have the new truck and the old truck parked next to each other for the couple of days. So that'd be great.
Captain Adam Hall says thanks to social media, there have been offers from around the country to help with the truck's restoration.
We've got a lot of interest and a lot of offers for help and assistance, everything from upholstering to bodyworks and engine rebuilds. But I expect it'll probably take 2 or 3 years to get it somewhere near its former glory, at which point we hope to be able to go out and do schools, go to shows, go to rusty iron rallies and so forth, and just show it off and put Bellbrook on the map. We're only a very small, fairly isolated village here, and it's nice to be able to show the rest of the world who we are and what we stand for.
Bellbrook Brigade member Elwin Toby also remembers seeing the truck in action at the Thungari community when he was a child.
It was a blessing for it to come back, because it gives memory to the elders that was on the fire brigade. So I knew of them, but it was a mentor for me too, to see, you know, our Indigenous, you know, leaders step up and have a go. It really inspired me, you know, as a child, watching, you know, our uncles and aunties jump on the truck and, you know, become firefighters. And that's where I get my inspiration from. I feel like helping others helps me.
Elwin is also a cultural arts teacher, and he's created an Indigenous artwork which now features on Bellbrook's current fire truck.
Well, I did the artwork, it's just a recognition for our a local Indigenous population that lives in Bellbrook and in the wider community. So the artworks is about coming together in the fires, so we work as a team.
It's hoped the new and old trunks will eventually be displayed side by side.
Just great to keep that history in going, you know, so I'm very proud to be a part of the job, you know.
So we're looking for a cow pat with a little bit of dirt that's come up through it.
At a farm on far north Queensland's Atherton Tablelands, these people are behaving in a rather strange way. They're searching through piles of cattle dung and looking for a little animal that has one of the most unappealing and yet important jobs in the world, eating animal droppings. Dr. Bernard Duby is the world's leading ecologist specialising in studying this small and misunderstood creature.
This is a beetle that comes from the high rainfall districts of eastern Africa, and we introduced it about 30 years ago. And it's got a very restricted distribution up here on the Atherton and hardly anywhere else in Australia. But up here it's doing a great job. And it, what it does, it digs a tunnel to about 20 centimetres, something like that, lines the tunnel with dung. And so the earthworms that are here, they go down feeding on the dung that's lining the tunnel. And then down below, the beetle puts perhaps a half a litre of dung, something like that, a huge amount really, and lays a whole lot of eggs in it. The eggs hatch into larvae. The larvae then eat all of the dung. The adult beetles feed on the dung juices and the larvae feed on the dung fibre. And so then the larvae crap out all of the, excuse the word, but they crap out this processed stuff, which is rather like compost. And so you've down at 20 centimetres, you've now got earthworm casts, and down below you've got a great big pile of plant nutrients ready. And so the roots grow down there, and so you get increased production and increased carbon storage because it's a relatively permanent change in the structure of the soil. So the dung beetles are a great benefit in terms of increasing the permeability of the soil to moisture. But up here, the water goes straight in. So the primary benefits up here are to get the dung underground, stop pasture fouling, and also then to increase the subsoil fertility of the region. And so this will last for quite some years. And so over time, the whole pasture will be processed by dung beetle activity. And our experiments from southern Australia indicate that we get about a 30% increase in productivity due to the dung burial activity of the beetles.
Hello, I'm Tanya Murphy. I've come along to Victor and Gail Abernethy's property at Wandekla, about 90 kilometres inland from Innisfail, where the couple run a small herd of cattle. Gail says these dung beetles are vitally important for the local cattle industry.
Cattle are introduced to Australia. There are native dung beetles, but they eat marsupial dung, so kangaroos, wallabies. So before the CSIRO back in the 70s and 80s introduced dung beetles from overseas, there were lots of dung on the ground because it wasn't being processed. Cattle dung attracts flies, and that's why the Australians have the fly salute and had corks on their hats, because there were so many flies. The dung beetles take the manure and bury it. So that reduces effluent runoff into the reef, it improves the soil quality, it creates aeration of the soil, so you've got less runoff from rainwater. But there's so little research and development being done in northern Australia, where all the cattle live. Most of the research about dung beetles is in southern Australia, but most of the cattle live in northern Australia.
Gail began ordering dung beetles from southern breeders in 2014. But she soon realised there was very little information about which species survive well in northern Australia at different times of year. So she and a group of other farmers on the Atherton Tablelands obtained a landcare grant to undertake their own research. And they haven't been afraid to get their hands dirty.
You need a shovel and a bucket and manure. So you take your shovel and you find a cow pat that's at least 24 hours old and put it in your bucket with some soil and then empty some water into it, and they will float to the top in a graceful style, and then you can collect them and see what you've got. So we have been one group of farmers of 15 who have collected beetles once a month for 12 months, and we now know we have 9 separate species of introduced dung beetles and 4 predatory species. So they're the smaller ones who eat the fly larva, not so much the dung. And some of our beetles don't live down south. They're just up here in our tropics.
Natural resource management consultant Louise Gavin is assisting the group with the project, while Dr. Duby is in charge of beetle identification. He says the study has revealed a gap in the winter population of dung beetles, which the group can now address to ensure year-round waste management.
What this project has shown is that we have quite a diversity of beetles here. They're active during the summer, but at this time of the year, in autumn and winter, although there are some beetles present and they're burying dung, they're not very common. Now, we've imported a summer rainfall beetle from Southern Africa and called Anitis kaffa. And this is a great beetle, and it's active in autumn and in spring, primarily in autumn in the summer rainfall regions of Southern Africa. And so I've been dealing with some land care groups and with other groups. In particular, at Cowra, there's a men shed, and the men shed have been manufacturing field cages for us. And then we've been putting these out on properties and inoculating them with dung beetles. And then the farmers have been growing up the dung beetles and redistributing them. So that's what we hope to do up here. We hope that we can get some financial support to establish a dung beetle importation program again, bringing in this particular beetle, which is going to be most beneficial, in my view, at any rate.
Dung beetle expert Dr. Bernard Duby, ending that report from Tanya Murphy in far north Queensland, where farmers are taking a close look at their cowpats and studying the beetles. You can see more on that story by heading online to the RN homepage. Look for Country Breakfast under the programs tab. I'm Clint Jasper with you on RN this morning. Still to come, how an Indigenous ranger has overcome a fear of heights and is relishing a role caring for country from the sky. And sweet, juicy and delicious, figs are a special fruity treat that also have a rich history. We'll meet a woman on a mission to preserve their heritage.
My son, my partner, Keith, have a very dodgy old car and a very dodgy old van, and we are looking for heritage figs, for lost figs in the deserts.
In her dodgy old vehicles, Victorian woman Yasmin Sadler is travelling the country. She's on a mission to preserve a fruit tree that was brought to Australia by migrants when they made a new life down under.
It's to preserve our heritage, natural fig heritage, that was brought out here by the migrants. They brought their best with them. They're still in our landscape. They still grow. So the passion to preserve them, to hear their stories, and to see them being grown again by people that will understand the story behind these figs.
Hello, I'm Kelly Hollingworth. I've met up with Yasmin in the southern New South Wales town of Euston, where she's seeking out an old fig tree that's growing on the banks of the Murray River. Her fig hunt is already into its third year, and in that time she sourced hundreds of cuttings.
In Melbourne, I travelled over 9 field fig trips. I sourced almost 100 trees, and these produced about 300 plants, rooted plants in pots. The cuttings, that would have been times 4 or 5. So all these cuttings sourced from those trees I freely also shared to other fig growers, because that is very important, not to just rely on one's own skills of rooting them and propagating, but rather share and have other people examine, try to ID and grow them in different climates.
Are they difficult to propagate?
They're very easy to propagate, and they will live quite happily in a small pot as long as you bring the moisture and nutrients up to them.
On this trip, Yasmin Sadler is heading to Maari in northern South Australia at the junction of the Unadatta and Birdsville tracks. She'll be looking for fig trees planted by early camelliers, and she'll be relying on an old-fashioned method to hunt them down.
Word of mouth. I hope that some people will get a glimmer and remember a fig tree they saw somewhere and will point me to it, and I will go. I'll take cuttings, I'll take photos, document the tree as much as I can, and we'll try to grow it and trace it back to where it came from. This is the biggest trip, and it's going to be some many hundreds of kilometres, and we're heading along the Murray and then up through the Flinders Ranges and into Murray, and we hope to contact people there that have family connections to the original Camelias, and we hope to follow the trails of Camelias, and I understand that the Udna Datta track is directly the result of these of their movements. So we're hoping that by following somewhere, we will find their trees. And this is a total hypothetical situation. We may have to go into Alice around that area and then down to Ceduna. We've been told that there may be figs in Ceduna, and then along the coast back to East Gippsland. And we know there is a lot of figs in the Adelaide area. We've been invited by figgers there to come, and they'll show us some fig trees they know of. And I understand there is also an active garden club near the Grampians, and they do have some figs along those farms there. So we hope to do that on our way back.
If this trip goes to plan, you could potentially have a lot of fig cuttings. How will you manage that?
The post office is the key. As soon as we collect cuttings, I will prepare them for travel and head straight for the nearest post office. And they will be sent out to fellow fig growers around different parts of Australia, where they will identify them by the number, by the code that I give them, and we will grow on and we will try to identify over the years. It's a long process. To ID a fig, it can take 3 years.
Here in Euston, Yasmin is caught up with Mick Harding, who is showing her a local fig tree that's believed to have been propagated from one that was planted nearby in the 1870s.
I say it came up on a paddle steamer. I reckon it would have come up from Renmark, was somewhere in South Australia, at Goolwa, and these 30 years that built the house there, they've somehow come by it. The variety is a brown turkey. It's lovely, fresh, dries lovely, and it's a big fig, you know, lovely big fig. I used to disc up close to the tree with a disc and tractor, and of course I used to cut some of the roots, so little trees used to come up. So I used to pot them all and give them away. They're all around Robinvale and Euston. Yeah, they're big trees now.
This is exactly the sort of situation that I'm looking for. A very 1800s fig tree that has been propagated and passed on by people that loved the fig. And by loving it, it's survived. It's here. And we can find the identity of it. It could be French or it could be a brown turkey. Whatever it is, it has been loved and can become part of our Australian heritage.
Joanne Pomery is gathering her gear and checking equipment before she takes to the sky.
That's right, boys. These are the incendiaries, and we feed into the rain dance machine that injects the glycol into the incendiaries. They fall down, takes 30 seconds before they're on fire. So we're just going to check if it's running smooth.
The senior ranger with the Noombawa Noombarindi Rangers will soon be soaring high above this small coastal community in the southeast corner of Arnhem Land.
Just in case there's fire inside the machine.
She's part of a crew conducting an aerial burning program. By dropping incendiaries from a helicopter and starting small savanna fires, they're reducing the risk of destructive wildfires later in the season.
So just scratch them, they fall down, just to make sure this runs around smooth.
And how long will you be up in the air today?
A couple of hours today.
Yeah. Right, and they're just starting to light now?
Yeah. They just get a bit smoky and then they'll turn into fire.
Right, and so the aim, I guess, is that some of these catch light and start burning and you can burn off country that way.
Yeah.
All of them, not some of them.
Yeah.
All of them, right.
Hello, I'm Max Rowley. I'm here in the remote community of Noombawa on the Gulf of Carpentaria in the Northern Territory. After years working as a ranger, this is Joanne Pomeroy's first season up in the helicopter, and it's a role she's enjoying, despite a fear of heights.
I really love it. It's good, it's not so scary, but it's good to see where area you are and what you're looking after and what you're doing about it.
Is it what you expected before you did it?
No, it's quite, looks quite easy when you're up there now, but it's just a bit scary when the wind blows and that, and but it's pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like it's taken a bit of courage for you to do this because you're not too fond of heights, is that right?
I'm pretty scared of heights, but seeing the pilot and knowing that I've got to do my job gives me the confidence in myself to do it.
What made you decide, you know what, I don't love heights, but I'm going to do this anyway and I'm going to get up there and do this role?
Well, I don't like something to win me, so I want to try and deal with my fears and by go ahead and doing it, you know.
The aerial burning's coming to the end for the Rangers this year. When did you start?
We started in about 3 weeks ago with the aerial burning, as because of the grass is still wet with the weather changing, and we've done a whole big area within our SEAL IPA area.
How has the burning gone this year? Did you get as much burned as you would have liked?
Yeah, I think we did get through a lot, even though there are some places that didn't burn well because of the grass still green.
And how long have you been doing the aerial burning?
This is my first year this year to go up doing aerial burning in the helicopter. I've been in this job 3 years, so this is my first time up. And encouraging, we have a new lady that's joined us from the LOC program and being a guide for her.
LOC, that's Learning on Country?
Yes, Learning on Country.
So it's good to see some new rangers coming up as well.
Yes. I'd like to see more rangers.
Just take me through why it's important to do this aerial burning as well on country.
Aerial burning helps us to do fire breaks so we don't get a big wildfire at the dry seasons.
And now that you're wrapping up with the burning, what's next for you? What will the rangers be working on next?
We check our roads, make sure no trees have fallen over onto the tracks that go out to the outstations, and plus we'll be doing ground burning as well, some areas where we were a bit green when we started off.
Right, you'll be finishing off a few patches that you couldn't get to in the helicopter?
Yes. And Neem's tree, we'll be going and working on the Neem's weeds out at Wai Ikupa.
Thanks, Joanne. Have a good one up there.
Senior Ranger Joanne Pomeroy. She was speaking to our reporter Max Rowley in the remote northern community of Noombawa in Arnhem Land. And before that, Kelly Hollingworth chatted with fig hunter Yasmin Sadler, who's travelling the country on a mission to find and document Australia's heritage fig trees. You can read more on that fascinating story and all of the stories you've heard on today's program by heading online to the RN homepage. You'll find Country Breakfast under the Programs tab.
Hi, Waleed Ali here from the minefield. Scott Stevens over there. Every now and again, we abandon regular programming on the minefield and do a thing that Scott insists we call the art of living. What is it, Scott?
Well, basically, we take works of art, things that are meant to be taken seriously. It might be a television show, it might be a novel, it could even be a painting. And we try to subject them to a little bit of, let's say, moral scrutiny, but also hold up our own lives to their piercing gaze.
You can find it by following the minefield on the ABC Listen app, and I'll work on the name.
Queensland's Channel Country is often said to be naturally organic, but a traditional owner says she's worried any potential unconventional gas exploration, like fracking, would be detrimental to its organic beef industry. It's been almost 12 months since the Queensland government quietly granted oil and gas leases in the Channel Country after promising for years to protect its wild rivers and floodplains. Now there are calls for the outcome of stakeholder meetings to be made public. Madeline McCosker has this report.
Last year, the state government granted 11 petroleum leases across more than 250,000 hectares of land in the Channel Country to gas company Origin Energy. These leases could allow unconventional gas production, known as fracking, to occur. Locals were outraged by the news, saying they weren't consulted. As a result, the government formed an advisory group made up of traditional owners, community members, local governments, government departments, and landholders. The Lake Eyre Basin Advisory Group met with the government a handful of times to communicate their concerns over gas exploration, with their final meeting taking place last month. But the outcome of those meetings still remains secret. Delene Ray, General Manager of OBE Organic, says the meetings should be more open to those who, like her, were not involved.
I would have hoped that the Queensland Government would perhaps be more transparent about some of the outcomes of these discussions.
The Department of Environment and Science told the ABC in a statement last month the government would use the information from the advisory group to prepare a regulatory impact statement looking at the long-term sustainable management of the area. In a separate statement to the ABC, a spokesperson for the department said the government is still committed to protecting the long-term health and ecological integrity of the waterways and floodplains of the Lake Eyre Basin. Before the 2015 election, the government committed to restoring protections to the Wild Rivers, which would have limited gas exploration in the Channel Country. It came after they slammed the Newman government's 2013 decision to ditch the protection laws, which they labelled as environmental vandalism. In the elections following 2015, the government made similar promises, but Ms. Ray says those promises have not come to fruition.
The Queensland government have made that election promise through, I think, three election cycles now, and I don't think there's been too much evidence other than the stakeholder meetings that we're making any progress in meeting that election commitment. I haven't heard the government articulate how important the rivers in the Lake Eyre Basin are and how important it is to maintain the free-flowing nature of those rivers. I also understand that royalties are very important to the Queensland budget. I think everyone would be naive to think that the resources industry doesn't have a place in Queensland. However, unconventional gas does not have a place in the Lake Eyre Basin, in our opinion.
Wanganguru Yalla Yandi woman Karen Monaghan has lived in Windora her whole life and grew up swimming in the Cooper Creek. She hopes it's something her grandchildren will be able to experience, but is worried gas exploration and fracking would hurt her small community, the water it relies on, and the land around it.
Wanganguru Yalla Yandi land, it's been mistreated. And our land is our mother. You know, that is part of us and who we are. It's embedded in us, our country. That's our life. So if we look after our land will look after us. And it's not okay on any formal way to mistreat our land and treat it like it's going to be there forever.
Despite a frustrating lack of consultation initially, Ms. Monaghan says she's hopeful communication from the government would improve.
It's never too late, and I think that our government just has to step up and step out and reach out to us. It's never too late.
She says she's concerned about what further gas exploration would mean for beef operations in the area.
And the minute we frack, you can't call it organic beef, because that water runs everywhere. If fracking happens on the scale that the licences have been given, it's not going to be good. It's going to set our land and our country back.
All of the cattle sourced by OBE Organic come from the Channel Country, and they market its products as being seasoned by nature. But Managing Director Delene Ray says if fracking becomes a reality, it will risk the organic status of the basin, which is one of the last remaining free-flowing river systems in the world.
From an organic producer's perspective, if there is any resource activity on organic producer's property, they're going to be concerned about fencing to ensure that the equipment is fenced in, and also any chemicals that are used, that they're stored correctly.
Ms. Ray says she's not convinced potential risks to the environment could be adequately mitigated, adding she fears large mining operations would not understand the needs of organic operations to retain their certification.
It's a geographic masterpiece. It's a unique environment. There's nowhere like it on the planet. And it is reliant on free-flowing rivers. I think it's important that the Queensland government understands that any activity in that part of the world is likely to have significant consequences with regard to water flow. It is naive to believe that it won't. What we know from experience is that typically the resources in the industry don't necessarily like going off script. They've got one script that they'd like to use for all producers, and they'd like all producers to accept that script, and that's just not how it works out there, certainly on organic properties.
Daylene Ray is the Managing Director of OBE Organic, ending that report by Madeline McCosker. In a statement to the ABC, a spokesperson from the Queensland Department of Resources said any application cannot be granted unless native title has been addressed properly, and an Origin Energy spokesperson says it's very early days with regard to any proposed exploration activity in those areas, and they always look to establish positive relationships and reach agreements to access resources on good terms. A new report pins the total value of water rights in the southern Murray-Darling Basin at $30 billion, up 13% over the 12 months to July this year. It's a market that's tightly held and underpinned by consistently strong demand for agricultural commodities. Consultancy firm Aether has published its annual water markets report, and I asked Associate Director Erin Smith to explain the differences between a water entitlement and water traded in the allocation market to kick off our discussion.
Absolutely. So, look, a water entitlement is an ongoing right to a share of water within a given system. And so one of the ways you can think about a water entitlement is to just think about it as a bucket. And then what fills your bucket up in a given year is the water allocation. So the water allocation is the actual water that's available. The way we talk about that is you get water allocated to your entitlements, and once you have that water, it's available to be used, or you can also trade it. And the important thing to understand about water allocations is that they are influenced by how much water is actually available in the system.
Well, we are talking on the release of Aether's Water Markets report, so let's get into the allocation market. This year, you've described a double whammy impact there. What did you mean by that?
What we mean by the double whammy effect is really a combination of high water supply or water availability with conditions that tend to suppress demand. And so to unpack that a little bit more, what we saw over the last water year was we had very high allocations to entitlements, and they came through very early in the year, so that's the water supply piece. And then what we saw was it continued to rain. And what this does, particularly if it's widespread rainfall across the agricultural regions, it provides in-crop rainfall, and that tends to suppress demand. People essentially don't need to go to the water market to purchase water. When those factors combine, you tend to get this very strong downwards pressure on prices, and prices can fall very, very rapidly. But what we need to keep in mind is that these supply and demand conditions will change again in the future. Allocation markets respond to supply and demand, and so when the water supply is constrained again, you would expect allocation prices to increase.
If we take a look at the entitlement market, the report has Aether's index of those prices laid out in a very handy graph, which I can easily describe for listeners. It just goes up and up. What is behind this sustained rise?
Yeah, so entitlement markets have gone through, I guess, a couple of phases in terms of the chart that you're referring to there. They were sort of at their low point around 2013, 2014-ish, and really since then it has rapidly appreciated. There's a bit of stabilisation through 1920 and 2020-21, but over the last 12 months we have seen a return to increasing entitlement prices. And in terms of what's really driving the reason that they've gone up over the last 12 months is a couple of things. One is the fact that we've had really strong economic conditions for Australian agriculture. Over the last couple of years, or actually for a reasonably long period of time, interest rates have been low. We've also had commodity prices for a lot of irrigated agricultural crops be incredibly high, and that's been especially the case for cotton and rice over the last 12 months. And the other thing that we've seen over the last 12 months as well is just that there's a limited supply of entitlement coming to market.
Is there anything you think that would moderate this insatiable demand we've seen and the price rises that come with it for entitlements?
Yeah, look, that's a great question, and we draw attention to this in the Water Markets report. People are starting to raise questions around where water entitlement prices might go from here. And there's probably two main things that are on people's mind. One is the fact that we're starting to see interest rates increase again, and then also the fact that we are in a wet cycle and therefore we've got low allocation prices, which will be reducing yields. And I guess related to the fact that we're in this wet part of the cycle as well is really our reflections on the outlook for the next 12 months through this water year. And given how much water is in the dams at the moment, they're incredibly full. We also have a very wet outlook as well over the next couple of months as well. So those conditions really indicate that things are set for allocation prices to be quite low over the next 12 to 24 months. And water users in particular can look forward to a couple of years whereby the price of water is not sort of their key concern.
Erin, it's been about a year since the final ACCC report into Australia's water markets was released. That report came with a roadmap for reform. How far down that path have we gone?
Yeah, that's right. So we saw the final report from the ACCC come out in early 2021, March, from memory. And the previous government established a water market reform roadmap process whereby they formed an advisory panel to provide advice to the government on potential next steps for the ACCC's recommendations. So that process was initiated late last year. The new Labor government is committed to that process. And what we've seen so far is that some preliminary advice from the advisory panel was released in February this year. And now what we're looking forward to is the fact that the final report will be completed by the end of September. So this is certainly one to watch in terms of the final content of that report.
Has anything changed about the way that the market actually operates since that came out, or that piece around transparency even?
As you know, water market transparency has really been a key issue for a number of years now, and that was certainly highlighted in the ACCC's report and recommendations, and we have certainly seen some great improvements in this space from a number of different agencies, including the Basin State Governments, the Bureau of Meteorology and the MDBA. So for instance, we've started to see new data being available on the New South Wales and the Victorian Water Registers, in particular around the purpose of allocation trades, whether they are sort of spot market allocation trades, is it a trade for carryover, is it a lease, those sorts of things. So that's bringing a lot more detail and information there in terms of allocation markets. We've seen South Australian government make some changes to the way they present the information in their River Murray allocation statements. And likewise, there has also been a number of sort of new dashboards and water markets portals that have been released by the Basin State Governments and the Bureau of Meteorology. So there's a number of things happening in that space, really looking at improving the information that is available and its accessibility.
In the research that went into this report, obviously you look at a lot of data. Was it easier with those registers? Did you find the process of accumulating all this data easier with those changes made?
You know, that's a great question. And in terms of the AFA Water Markets Report, we draw heavily on the trade data that is available on the state water registers. And because we've got that new purpose of allocation trade data there, what we've been able to do is actually really refine our analysis. And so our volume weighted average prices do draw on that purpose of allocation trade data. In the past, we were needing to analyse the data and filter it purely on the basis of the price information that was available. But now with that better purpose of allocation trade data, it means we can refine and improve the analysis that we do.
AFA Associate Director Erin Smith ending that interview on a positive note. The mud is slowly clearing and the water markets are becoming more transparent than they once were, although there are many more steps along the reform roadmap yet to be taken. My thanks to Serena Locke, Kath McAllen and Matthew Sigley for helping bring Country Breakfast together this week, and a very good morning to the rest of the wonderful crew taking you through Saturday mornings here on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.